Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Frank Stella, the prolific painter, printmaker, sculptor, and muralist. Susan Lewis takes us to a new exhibition at the University of Pennsylvania Museum, fulfilling a prophecy, the past and present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania. In the second of a two-part series, David Patrick Stearns looks at the history of Leonard Bernstein's Candide, and a production now at the Arden Theatre in Philadelphia, and Jason Pfeiffer visits the Philadelphia Museum of Art's new exhibition, G's Bend, the architecture of the quilt. We'll hear from some of the women who created the quilts on display. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
For going on half a century, Frank Stella has been among the most respected and influential artists in this country. And although he's been repeatedly accused of reinventing himself over the years, in truth his progression from medium to medium and the accompanying changes in style and dimension have been more evolutionary than revolutionary. Currently, three Frank Stella works can be seen at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, a print and a painting in the exhibition Reverberations, Modern and Contemporary Art from the Bank of America collection, and a sculpture in the Academy's permanent collection. I met with Frank Stella earlier this week. There are three pieces here at PAFA at the moment from three different decades, one from the 1960s, the Damascus Gate, one from the 70s, part of the Racetrack series, and something from the 80s called Press Gang Sailor.
Yes.
You've, at this point, gone and looked at them again. What did you think?
Well, I was happy to see them. I mean, I guess you can say it's sort of like old friends, but I, you know, in the context of the whole show and everything, it was interesting and especially a lot of fun for me to see art that I recognized. I really recognized all of the other artists, so I realized I'm quite familiar with the art of the 60s anyway, and maybe even the 70s.
When you look back at those pieces, do you think about the artist you were then, or what's the sense? Do you have a sense of nostalgia?
No, I don't actually have any sense of nostalgia, and I don't have much sense about myself, actually. What I said just before was, I mean, I have a sense of the other artists, of the people that were working around me or that I was working with in a certain sense. And there was something interesting about the development of what people were doing, I guess, when I was first thinking about or, I suppose, in a sense, becoming an artist. That's somehow what I'm most moved by somehow, because what I liked 40 or 50 years ago, I like even more 50 years later.
You've worked in many different media, more than many artists. When you're selecting a medium for a particular subject matter, is it that you are now working in that medium, or that just happens to be the best medium to express yourself at that time?
You know, I worked with, in a very conventional sense, making paintings on canvas. And then things really changed for me in, you know, towards the very end of the 60s or the beginning of the 70s when I began to work on the Polish Village series. And that those drawings and the thought that the way I was thinking lent itself to relief. And once I was making relief, then it became natural to use materials. In fact, I started out by making stretched irregularly shaped canvas and then putting material on top of the canvas, which was, you know, was really kind of going the wrong way. So then I began to build the stretches up with board and wood and eventually metal honeycomb sheets, honeycomb panels. So I think that there was a big change in with the Polish Village work, and the change is simple. Before that, I made a painting, or I worked on a surface in a conventional way. And after that, I felt the need to build a painting. So I built the painting, and then I painted it, or I painted on it, or I used the materials as collage and everything as a form of painting. So I made something to begin with that was mine. I literally, as I said, I simply built the painting. And so I think that changed my way of thinking.
And that then evolved into sculpture proper.
Yes, yeah, inevitably, as you might say.
Because there is a tendency when talking about you, I mean, it's clear that it was an evolution, that it was a progression, but you most regrettably often see the word reinvention in connection with your name.
Yeah,
do you find that
horrible
offensive?
Word. Yeah, yes. Well, not, I mean, not offensive. It's a poor use of the language. I mean, that's all I can say. But Part of the problem is you can describe it physically, so you move from one surface to another kind of surface to build up surfaces, and then you move to the idea of sculpture. Essentially, you're talking about something in the round. But although the paintings and reliefs are on a wall, the painting still, the sculpture does sit on the ground. So you're really the floor plane and the wall plane, you could say, if you wanted to be cute, are interchangeable. So it's not so different. But I think there is a basic difference. And for me, the difference is highlighted by an example, in examples of work of Picasso. So say, for example, after synthetic cubism or after cubism, as it were, it would be inevitable that Picasso would move to abstraction, but he didn't. Okay, we know that. And so you have to say, well, what's the reason? Or is there a reason? And I think that there is, I have an explanation that works for me, and I'm not trying to put it off on anybody else. But for me, essentially, cubism is planar. And the planar surfaces and the planar relationships, in a certain sense, were interesting to Picasso and dynamic and offered all kinds of possibilities. But in the end, if you push them to the direction that they wanted to go, the planes towards abstraction, that wasn't satisfying for Picasso. I think it was he needed to have a sense of volume. And so the volume negates the sense of abstraction that was seemed inevitable with planar, with cubism.
And you talk about the satisfaction of this evolution with him. Yeah. Would it be possible for you now, working in large three-dimensional media, to go back to a simple canvas?
Well, it's not possible. I mean, I can't even think that way. So, I mean, and the other thing is, I mean, and I don't mean this in a fatuous way. I mean, I can't go back. And I'm interested in what I'm doing because although there... I found a way to, for myself anyway, so that I don't have a conflict between painting and sculpture, or relief painting and painted relief. As far as I, as it works for me, it's very satisfactory. I mean, it's a horrible way to express it to say that it's pictorially informed relief or sculpture, but it is. I mean, it comes out of painting, out of my instincts for painting. And what I've always done and the way I understand what I understand painting to be or whatever it can be. So that's the way I work. That's the way I see things. So it's not a problem for me.
You're in your 70s now. I heard an interview recently with Damien Hirst, who's in his 40s, and he was talking about his legacy even at his age. Do you think about what you left behind or what will be?
No, but I'm interested in Damien's legacy. Now he can become a philanthropist.
I think he already has.
Yeah. No, I find it absurd. I mean, at the most that it can ever be embarrassing that people are overtly influenced by you. I mean, it would be nice if you could say that you had an idea and you had a way of working or some kind of things were beneficial to others. And I see some things that I say, oh, well, that, you know, that looks like something that I did. But I wouldn't dare be presumptuous enough to say, because if they're really good, they would have got there by themselves, and they probably did. I just see a reflection of myself in their ability and then their accomplishment. So I discount it.
Frank Stella. Two of his works can be seen in Reverberations, Modern and Contemporary Art from the Bank of America collection at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. It ends tomorrow.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
According to conventional history, few, if any, Lenape Indians remained in Pennsylvania after the 18th century, most having been killed or driven west by European settlers. However, a new exhibition at the Penn Museum tells the story of those who stayed, forming communities whose members hid their Lenape identities, yet managed to continue and pass on their traditions in secret for nearly two centuries. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to Fulfilling a Prophecy, the Past and the Present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania.
When University of Pennsylvania anthropology student Abigail Selden was putting together a one-case exhibit about what happened to the Lenape people, she met with the elders of today's Lenape Nation of Pennsylvania and asked them why there was virtually nothing about them in the literature.
Every book I've read says that you don't exist and that you're not in Pennsylvania anymore. And they said, yeah, we know. I said, but you're here. And they said, well, we've been keeping our history a secret for 200 years, so of course it's not in the books.
The Lenapes' cautious willingness to share their history was a doorway, opened a crack, into another culture, a natural fit with a museum dedicated to understanding the world's cultural heritage, let alone one in its own backyard. Selden's advisor, anthropology professor Bob Prusell, curator of North America at the Penn Museum, says that while most of the cultures in the museum are presented at a point in the past...
For example, ancient Egypt, we have incredible collections here, but there's not a lot on contemporary Egypt here. So one of the things that we want to do with Native America is to show the continuities and connections between the archaeology, the history, and the contemporary communities.
So what started out as a small student project grew into a museum show covering hundreds of years. Co-curated by Selden, along with Chief Bob Red Hawk Ruth and Shelley DePaul of the Lenape Nation, it took its shape and context from a story handed down through the generations called Prophecy of the Fourth Crow, about, among other things, hiding and returning.
Long ago it was said that a fox will be loosened on the earth. Also, it was said four crows will come.
As the story goes, the first crow flew in harmony with the Creator. The second crow tried to clean the world, but he became sick and died. The third crow saw his dead brother, and he hid. The fourth crow flew the way of harmony again with the Creator. The ending comes full circle.
Caretakers, they will live together on the earth.
As told here, the first crow in the prophecy corresponds to the Lenape before the first contact with Europeans. The second crow represents the period from about 1600 until 1800, when initially peaceful coexistence with William Penn and others deteriorated in subsequent generations. This is starkly illustrated by an enlarged 1764 ad placed by one of William Penn's sons in Benjamin Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette.
John Penn is offering payment to civilians who capture Delaware or Lenape individuals or who kill them and turn in their scalps as evidence. And the payment for a male over 10 years of age was $134 and for a female $50. So there was a really clear heritage in Pennsylvania of indiscriminate violence against people of Native American heritage.
By the beginning of the 19th century, remaining Lenape had either fled or gone into hiding. And it is the next 200 years of secrecy, represented by the third crow, that is the driving force of this exhibition. Chief Bob Redhawk says his people found ways to survive.
Whether it was intermarriage, whether it was hiding who you are, you did whatever you could. If you could pass as a white or even as African-American, and this is even during segregation times, we were low men on the totem pole.
Passing as members of other ethnic groups was in some cases made easier because intermarriage was common. Selden says Lenape women, for example, married German farmers and kept connections to their land. Generations of intermarriage eventually created a population with looks as diverse as the larger culture. Children could be blonde and fair-skinned, dark with black hair, and everything in between. Outwardly, they assumed a non-Lenape identity. In the privacy of family gatherings, they continued to practice Lenape traditions and pass down stories. Even outward appearances were full of symbols, as shown in this exhibition on things as ordinary as a kitchen apron with a particular stitch along the bottom, or a wooden fence post with a subtle carving.
Poles like this one were scattered throughout farmland. This has a face on it pretty clearly, but it could just be a signpost.
And what is the face?
It represents Meesing, who's the protector of the woodlands.
The importance of secrecy was drummed into the youngest of children, as evidenced by a rag doll in this show.
If you look carefully underneath her hair, which is now pulled to both sides, you can see that there's a second face. And this was a doll that was made for a little girl by her Lenape grandmother in the 1940s. And the woman told the little girl that this doll had the second face and that this represented the little girl's Lenape face and her identity, which she had to keep a secret because she could not tell anybody who she was.
Secrecy, rooted in fear, became part of the culture. But now, perhaps it is indeed the time of the fourth crow. In recent years, more people have begun to openly acknowledge their Lenape heritage, particularly as caretakers of nature. In 2002, the Lenape Nation signed the first Treaty of Brotherhood with churches and other community groups, pledging to support the Lenape cultural education programs and their work for the environment. The chief himself has traveled openly internationally, on tour with his large drum, which for now sits in a gallery at the Penn Museum, along with artifacts and photographs, evidence of children and parents, grandparents and great-grandparents.
These people were living, breathing people, and it's because of their ways of surviving that we're here today, and we're hoping that our children can come in here now and be proud.
It is their story, and it is our story, a rich texture in the national fabric, an important part of what it means to be an American, native or not.
That report was by WRTI's Susan Lewis. Fulfilling a prophecy, the past and present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania runs through September 13th of next year at the Penn Museum. After decades of revision, surgery and evolution, Leonard Bernstein's Candide has gone from something actors needed to salvage to something they have to live up to. Philadelphia's Arden Theatre, which opened its production of the show on Wednesday, was faced with casting voices of operatic quality and actors with classical theatre chops, plus staging almost as many global locales as Around the World in 80 Days. So why do the chorus girls wear simple black cocktail dresses? In the second of two reports, the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns talked to cast, crew and understudies to see why their five intensive weeks of rehearsals yielded one of the simplest of all possible Candides.
Arden Theatre artistic director Terrence Nolan isn't one to have sleepless nights, but Candide, he says, cost him more than anything else he's ever done. Just on a superficial level, how do you keep the city straight in a story about a collection of young innocents who are scattered around 18th century Europe and South America, surviving earthquakes, sieges, and even utopia? By his Tuesday rehearsal, Nolan was polishing dialogue in ways not often encountered in Broadway musicals, clarifying long-term emotional arcs between Candide and his love Cunegonde, and deciding how their reunions in exotic places show their personalities growing or morals deteriorating.
Keep Paris and Rome sexy. Paris and Rome were about sex, not about romance. Because if it's romance, it makes no sense. It's about things that glitter. So, if that's about sex, then we get to You Were Dead, You Know, and it's love. It's that first time that you go, oh my God, I love him. I love her.
Is it true?
Is it true?
Cunegonde,
oh
my love, dear love.
That's the 1999 National Theatre of Great Britain cast. I saw it and loved the way it brought a serious underside to Candide. The Arden does that, too. But watching Nolan monitor the number of bracelets worn in the song Glitter and Be Gay, as well as probing 18th-century class distinctions, you realize how many different things Candide is about.
The notion of freedom as it plays in this play, uh-huh. Right? You were a slave.
Right.
And the fact that he has the ability to free you and to make you not just earlier you're his sidekick, his, but to make you his friend. Is a big deal.
You could ask, is anyone really supposed to ponder Broadway musicals? In a sense, Ben Dibble, who plays the title role, had no choice. The usual stuff just didn't work.
As an actor, my instinct is always to really lean into and sort of push on stuff, to give a lot of energy and a lot of attack. And at first, that was my impulse, but I realized that the more I pushed on it, the less it sort of gave back to me.
Even the flamboyant role of the old lady who sings, I am easily assimilated and what's the use, with many accents and one remaining buttock, had Mary Martello aiming for precision and essentials.
Taking it apart and breaking it down so that everything is clear, all the extraneous things are taken away. Sometimes that's hard for me because so many ideas will come in my head and I'll try to make all of them happen at once. It just can't be like that. The story's too big. So you have to get in there, you have to show exactly what you're doing and why, and get out.
But at what point does director Nolan know when a scene has gotten there?
When it seems easy, when there's extremity yet ease, when the actions and the ideas carry the actors, and they don't have to fabricate it. Part of it is to make sure that we know that we're satirizing something, that we're not parodying it. And parody is easy, and satire is very hard and very specific.
That also explains the plain black cocktail dresses. The audience shouldn't be so caught up in the surfaces that it misses the show's point. But where's that old Broadway sweat and that outrageous vibrato that sells the song to the back row seats? That idea is alive and selling very well at the Walnut Street Theater. Brassy Broadway will always be in style. So will the kind of opera productions where audiences clap for the scenery. At the Arden Theater, where there's not much scenery, we're looking at a new subgenre, the classicization of Broadway theater. What was once commercial entertainment is now given the Chekhov treatment in the nonprofit sector, and Candide is lucky for it. Production overkill may have been the death of the 1956 original. Vaudeville-style gags and drag made one subsequent Candide I saw at Minneapolis's August Guthrie Theater more exhausting than fun. Paring down Candide by playing the characters, not the laughs, makes so much sense that you wonder why more people hadn't thought of it sooner. There's always the danger that wiping away the glitz will reveal that what we thought was a great show is, well, more like Mamma Mia. It happens. But how will anybody know until they try?
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Candide is at the Arden Theatre in Philadelphia through October 19th. A new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art gathers together quilts created in one small Alabama community. It's the second show of quilts to come out of the area, known as G's Bend, and Philadelphia marks the final stop on a national tour. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the exhibition traces rich traditions of quilting in a place that's long had limited resources.
G's Bend, the architecture of the quilt, displays over 70 quilts by women from Boykin, Alabama, otherwise known as G's Bend. The show is organized by the Tinwood Alliance, an Atlanta-based foundation whose mission is to support underrepresented or unknown vernacular art, art created by people without formal training. William Arnett, who founded Tinwood, first traveled to G's Bend in 1997.
It was so isolated. It was in the bend of a river with one dirt road that was impassable except in perfect weather. There was no through traffic. You wouldn't go to G's Bend on the way to anybody.
Located in the bend of the Alabama River, the remote location and isolation of G's Bend has helped preserve the historic culture of the community. Named after Joseph G., a plantation owner who settled in the area in the early 1800s, the rural community is today mostly made up of the descendants of plantation slaves. Through the years, G's Bend has drawn sporadic attention. Journalists and photographers have passed through, documenting the region's poverty. A sewing cooperative there, the Freedom Quilting Bee, gained notoriety in the 1960s. As part of the civil rights movement, it was organized to bring jobs to women in the area. More recently, in 2002, the community again came into the spotlight when the first exhibition of quilts from G's Bend opened at the Museum of Fine Arts, Houston. These quilts bear a strong resemblance to the styles of certain household names like Matisse and Picasso. Dillis Blum, curator of costume and textiles at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, says G's Bend quilts imaginatively play with and deviate from traditional quilt patterns.
What you think of as sort of basic elements, you know, rectangles and squares, and how you can break up the design and just create the most extraordinary shapes, particularly, you know, with cloth, which has so much texture to it. There's just an amazing depth. You know, you couldn't paint these.
Quilting traditions in G's Bend have been passed down for well over a century. And a central theme of the latest exhibit is that the quilts often take inspiration from everyday life. Show organizers suggest that the quilt patterns frequently resemble the houses and outlying structures of G's Bend. Matthew Arnett of the Tinwood Alliance says as he helped research, photograph, and document the quilts of G's Bend, it became clear that many of the quilt makers imagine their quilts in architectural terms.
In the years of talking with the women, hearing them talk about how they build quilts, They don't talk about book patterns. They talk about the fences or the house or the barn.
One quilter featured in the show, 73-year-old Mary Lee Bendolf, says most of her ideas come from looking at things around her. She says quilt patterns are in everything, even a passing truck. And her approach to quilting hasn't changed much since she started as a 12-year-old.
Just the way my mama taught me, I still make my quilts that way.
Many women in G's Bend, like Bendolf, learned quilting from their mothers, aunts, and grandmothers, acquiring skills and honing practices that have endured for generations. Today, Bendolf can buy new quilting fabrics, but she still prefers to use scrap and recycled cloth, just like her mother and grandmother would have done. This is one of the striking aspects of G's Bend quilts. They're typically made from old, worn-out dresses, jeans, corduroys, and even feed sacks. It wasn't an aesthetic choice, but rather a reflection of the hard realities of life in G's Bend over the last century or so. Mary Lee Bendolf says nothing was wasted. Everything was used, including old quilts.
When it done got raggedy and old and not much good, we use it and take it and put it on the baby for a diaper. Because we didn't have no money to buy no diapers with, nothing like that. So we just used just what we had.
Bendolf says until more recently, quilts weren't considered art in G's Bend.
We didn't know anything about art. We were just making quilts and going to bed, keep warm. That's all we were doing.
But the quilts were and are a form of self-expression for many women in G's Bend. Mary Lee Bendolf's daughter-in-law, Louisiana Bendolf, says though she doesn't give much thought to where the ideas for her quilts come from, her quilts do reflect how she's feeling, what she's thinking about.
It's kind of like life is when you can't fix it, then you can go into a quilt and fix it in a way you want to, so that gives you a sense of relief in life.
Quilting has long been part of life's daily rhythm for many women in G's Bend. The tradition goes much deeper than merely making something decorative to keep a body warm. Mary Lee Bendolf says there's also a deeper dimension.
It calms your spirit. It makes you feel happy. You be singing and praying. And that's most of the thing that our quilt is telling the story about, singing and praying in the quilt. We was brought up that way.
The role of song and prayer in G's Bend quilting was evident during an opening event of the Philadelphia exhibition. A group of the quilters from Alabama seemingly spontaneously broke into song in the middle of the gallery.
You made me whole. You made me whole. You made me whole. Thank you.
In recent decades, the quilting traditions in G's Bend have been fading. It's become much easier and cheaper to use store-bought blankets. With a faster pace of life, younger people seem less interested in the time-consuming practice. But with national attention turned to G's Bend as a result of the two quilt exhibitions, there's been a resurgence of interest in quilting among G's Bend residents. In fact, about a third of the quilts in the Philadelphia show were created after 2002. 48-year-old Louisiana Bendolf says seeing how G's Bend quilts have struck a chord with so many has motivated her to keep quilting.
It's a deep sense of, inheritance that been passed on from generation to generation. I just feel like something I have to continue now.
There's a lot about the story of G's Bend that shouldn't be romanticized. It has a painful history of enslavement, segregation, and poverty. Yet the G's Bend exhibition offers a glimpse into how one group of women created works of great originality and stunning beauty in very hard times.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. G's Bend, the Architecture of the Quilt, is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art through December 14th. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.